This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 4th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design every single week on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we debate the future of one of Toronto's most contentious pieces of urban infrastructure, the Gardiner Expressway.
The engineers have estimated that it has about 6 years of fully good functional life left on it, and after that, it either has to be rebuilt or demolished or closed.
We discuss a house which takes exactly 4 minutes and 9 seconds to build.
It's always a challenge. You know, design is, if it's not interesting unless it's a great challenge.
And we pull our socks up in Turkey.
I want to see more Turkish designers that can create their own brands and go global afterwards.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Toronto's Gardiner Expressway is easily the city's most contentious piece of infrastructure. An elevated 8-kilometre-long highway that feeds traffic into downtown, the Gardiner gets little love. It's been called an eyesore, a blight on the skyline, and an impediment to properly developing the city's waterfront. It's also in danger of falling down, the city pouring tens of millions of dollars every year into maintenance alone. 50 years ago, the expressway's completion helped mark Toronto's arrival as a big, bustling, dynamic North American city. But those were different times, when the car was the height of the modern experience. Where does the Gardiner fit into Toronto's future? Monocle correspondent Chris Frey reports on the debate now underway.
Elevated downtown expressways. For the past 2 decades, major cities across North America have been grappling with what to do with them. In Boston, they tore down the I-93 and replaced it with a tunnel. They demolished the Embarcadero Freeway in San Francisco, but they opted to improve already existing roads and public transit. In Toronto, they've been arguing over the Gardiner Expressway almost since it was completed in 1964. 25 years ago, a commission was already recommending that the Gardiner come down. There have been numerous reports, proposals, and studies, some official, some not, but the Gardiner's future remains undecided. The adjective you hear most nowadays to describe the Gardiner is crumbling.
All of these freeway systems that have been built around the world last for about 50, 60 years, and they reach a point where they need a major rehabilitation.
That's Chris Glasek, Vice President of Planning and Design for Waterfront Toronto, the agency overseeing renewal projects for the city's Lake Ontario waterfront.
There is the reality that we have to invest hundreds of millions of dollars just to have what we have now. It will not stand up for too much longer without major investment. So the engineers have estimated that it has about 6 years of fully good functional life left on it, and after that, it either has to be rebuilt or demolished or closed. So we face a choice right now. We have to make a substantial public investment, no matter what.
Improve the Gardiner, replace it, remove it, or maintain it. Those are the options recently presented in a joint report by City Hall staff and Waterfront Toronto. And while the report stopped short of explicitly recommending a course of action, one option was ranked most preferable across various criteria. Removal. Dismantle the eastern section of the Gardiner and compensate with a revitalized 8-lane Lakeshore Boulevard to accommodate the displaced traffic.
The long-term financial impacts are the best with the remove. There's the maintenance costs of an at-grade street are very, very low compared to an elevated structure. So we've liberated a lot of future city expense on that. The capital costs actually lower for the remove option than the maintain option. And all the other benefits that you get in terms of being able to build a better Lakeshore Boulevard, improve safety. You know, if we're trying to think about how best to spend our money, perpetuating an expressway that was built for a society 50 years ago when things are changing.
Another key factor in their considerations was simply, how do you make a great waterfront?
And a lot of the population growth in the city is planned to happen down on the waterfront. So where you've now got empty industrial land and you say, well, why do you need to take this highway down? You will have 50 to 70,000 new residential buildings lining this corridor over the next 20 to 30 years.
Tearing down the east section of the Gardner will probably save the city tens, even hundreds of millions of dollars over the years. But it's also estimated that commute times for some drivers could increase by 20 to 30 minutes per day. Marcus G is the Toronto columnist for the Globe and Mail newspaper.
The problem is the Gardner runs along the south of the city, along the waterfront, and it connects the eastern and western expressways. So it creates a circular, a kind of a ring road for Toronto. So this would take a chunk out of that ring, and cars that would be rushing down the Don Valley Parkway, which is one of the main arterials into the city, would just be dumped sort of onto this new road with stoplights and pedestrians crossing and so on. Now, it looks very pretty in the artist's conceptions and so on, and I think it would be an improvement aesthetically, but we do have cars still. We have to move them around, and even if that becomes a less prominent, dominant mode of transport, I think for the foreseeable future, we still need highways. In this environmental assessment, it was said that, look, once we build these new subway lines, people will need the Gardner less, which is true, but we've been very slow in Toronto at building mass transit. I mean, it's all very well to say, look, people will take transit, but when is the transit coming? We don't know that yet. So to knock down this very important transportation link without an alternative seems rash.
Over the past decade, as debate over the Gardner waxed and waned, an interesting thing happened. Downtown Toronto densified dramatically. A neighborhood of condominiums and office towers grew up all around the expressway. It no longer seemed the barrier to development or lakefront access that it once did. It even looked a little less like an eyesore. The Gardner even has its fans. Of driving into the city along the elevated expressway, designer Bruce Mao has said, it's one of those few moments in urban Toronto that is really dramatic. To Mao, the Gardner and its sculptural presence is a missed design opportunity. Which brings us to one architect's vision for the Gardner. It's called the Green Ribbon.
In the most simplest terms, the Green Ribbon is a proposal to retain the Gardner Expressway in its current configuration, but to build a 7-kilometer roof over the top of the Gardner and create a 7-kilometer long 80-acre park in the middle of the city.
Les Klein is a co-founder at Quadrangle Architects and originator of the Green Ribbon concept.
Unfortunately, Toronto's been mired in a keep it or tear it down debate, an endless and fruitless debate for about 40 years. What we're trying to do is to step out of that rather difficult quandary and suggest an alternative that actually addresses our immediate needs and our long-term needs. What we propose in creating a park is, for example, first of all, reducing the heat island effect in the center of the city. Rather than having acres and acres of asphalt emitting heat, we now have a recreation space on top of the Gardner. Second of all, we reduce the need to salt, to plow, to ice. We protect the roadway from snow and rain. These are the things that are actually affecting the ongoing deterioration of the Gardner. We can finally give ourselves a chance to catch up on maintenance, which we've been ignoring for 30 years. And also, we maintain the other very, very important attribute of the Gardner, which is that it separates fast-moving traffic above from pedestrians below.
In the coming weeks, city staff will present their recommendation to demolish the eastern stretch of the Gardner to the Public Works Committee and City Council. It promises to be a loud and messy debate, complicated by politics, given that this is an election year for the mayor and city council. Mayor Rob Ford, running for re-election, has already said he opposes the recommendation of his own city staff. I asked Marcus G. how he thinks campaign politics will play into the debate.
It's very interesting because we have this suburban-urban divide here in Toronto. The current mayor, Rob Ford, came to office on a sort of wave of suburban anger. And, of course, knocking down a highway would fuel that anger and certainly play into his hands. So the other candidates are going to have to be pretty careful, those in the center and on the left, because if they come out supporting this removal, he's going to jump all over that. So I think they're looking at this very nervously.
And here's Chris Glazek again.
I think there's a risk of people saying, well, you know, we're a crowded city, we need highways, and not taking it any further than that to look at, you know, what's making us a crowded city and what's the infrastructure we need to address that, and then what's the best way to spend our money to get there. That may or may not happen during an election campaign.
For Monocle, in Toronto, I'm Chris Frey.
And now to look at what those four proposals for the Gardiner Expressway are and how the city's design will be affected. Alla John spoke to Luigi Ferrara, architect and director of the Centre for Arts and Design at George Brown College in Toronto.
There is a division in the city between those who would like to maintain it and those who are already seeing it. And I think it's almost an intergenerational division, because we've done a lot of work on transportation at the Institute Without Boundaries. And one of the things that we found was that, you know, people under 25 have a totally different relationship to car to autos and cars and vehicle ownership than the generation preceding them. And they're actually not interested in getting their licenses. They're not interested in necessarily driving, and they're really hoping to live and work downtown. In fact, a lot of corporate employers have had to reshift their headquarters to the center of the city because this generation just doesn't want to work.
So let's look at the options now then, Luigi, if we could. Toronto City staff have recommended four options for the crumbling Gardiner Expressway. If we can, let's get into that. What options strike you as the most relevant for this, a city like Toronto? Many are talking about burying it underground, tunneling the Gardiner through the city.
Yeah, tunneling, I think, would be a big mistake, would be disruptive to the water table. I don't think it's a viable solution. The three solutions that they've looked at are maintaining it, replacing it, and then tearing it down. So I think one of the more interesting things, the tearing it down through the evaluation that they did, was the least expensive and the most revenue generating for the city. But the thing that it does that is that it really increases the commute time for auto users, right? So
by
I think
20
what's
minutes.
Yes. And I think what is actually needed is actually to imagine that new boulevard with another piece of infrastructure that would actually get people downtown quicker by leaving their cars at the periphery, right? So is there something that you can do to actually, as you rebuild this boulevard, can you introduce something new? In Canada, we have at Center Island, you know, an overhead cable that actually takes you right across the island very quickly. Could you have down the middle of this boulevard a set of overhead public transit that would actually bring you in from the regions so that you could park at the edge of the city and come down and into the core? Another thing that would be interesting to look at, which planners in Japan and Russia have been looking at, is the idea of using roller coaster technology for public transit. It's actually very cost-saving. There's a precedent. The subway in Montreal is kind of designed so that as you arrive at a station, there's a hill so that you slow down, and then as you leave, you speed up. So if you imagine a set of stations with gently rolling roller coaster technology, you could get a big number of people into the city using very, very little energy and actually making something that's fun. So I think we need a bit more imagination, because what you want is a win-win for everyone. You want that commute time for the people who are outside the city to be reduced through a new piece of infrastructure that's not polluting and that makes their commute easier and better. And you want the city to be able to grow and this new compact city to be able to develop. And you can't do that without getting rid of the Gardiner and really turning it more into a grade-related, complete street kind of city.
Luigi Ferrara, architect and director of the Centre for Arts and Design at George Brown College in Toronto, in conversation with Ale John there. After the break, I'll be catching up with Fiona Wilson in Tokyo.
What makes a good toy? Well, to find out, Monocle Films dropped in on the International Toy Fair in Nuremberg to discover the companies and the concepts with the X Factor.
Ultimately, who's a toy for? Just maybe the great resilience of the toy industry, all of the big sales and buzz and growth, isn't a simple matter of spoiled kids after all. Maybe it's a case of a previous generation's children, all grown up, parents eyeing new products with cash in their pockets and a nostalgic glint in their eyes.
Big players, big business at the Nuremberg Toy Fair. Now playing in the films menu on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Now for a quick roundup of all the design news in Japan, I chatted earlier to our Asia Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson about a handful of exhibitions that have recently caught her eye, including one particularly fishy one.
Tokyo is always full of incredible exhibitions, I have to say. Really obscure niche exhibitions, as well as the big blockbusters. You know, there's a big Andy Warhol exhibition going on at the moment. But I was looking at the slightly smaller ones, and there's one that's really, really interesting for anyone who's interested in architecture. There's an exhibition of, it's actually drawings, models, photographs by an architect called Kameki Tsuchiura and his wife Nobuko. And if you know anything about Japanese modernism, these two, basically they joined in when Frank Lloyd Wright was building the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo in 1921. They joined the project and they ended up moving to the States for a few years, came back and pretty much applied what they'd learned to houses in Tokyo. So for early modernism in Japan, they're pretty key figures. And there's a great exhibition at the Edo Tokyo Open Air Museum. Basically an array of houses, shops, all sorts of random buildings that have been collected, old buildings from many periods, actually. It's not just old wooden houses. Some of them are quite recent. Saving them from demolition, and they've put them all in a park. And fantastic. If you're interested in domestic architecture, it's brilliant.
And they've sort of rebuilt them on site and you can go in and wander around, or...
Yeah, you can go in. I mean, absolutely. You know, and there are some... Kunio Maekawa, who's another key modernist, his house is also in this museum, complete, you know, with all the decor inside. You can go and have a good nose around. So for anyone interested in architecture, pretty much any period, because they've got farmhouses, they've got dentists, there's a kabuki theatre, it's fantastic. And this is just a good reason to go there, actually.
Wow. And how recent do they come up to? What's the most sort of recent building in there? Or is it more of a historical...
Yeah, I mean, mid-century is where the, you know, is considered the modern period. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, the problem in Tokyo is there was a big earthquake in 1923 and then firebombing in 1945. So the city was really obliterated a couple of times over in the 20th century. So saving these few buildings is really valuable, because there isn't an awful lot of old architecture in Tokyo. You've been here, you know. So it actually plays quite an important role. So, you know, there's like, it's a flower shop. It's not necessarily something that's absolutely extraordinary or architecturally noteworthy. It's just an ordinary building, but it's a pre-war building, and that is in itself, that makes it interesting.
Another showcase of the great things Japanese does, the D&D department have sort of striving on with a new exhibition, aren't they?
I mean, it's just so fascinating with D&D department. I mean, I talked to them at the very beginning of when they just started out doing these projects. You know, they were a graphic design company, basically, and the owner, very interested in antiques, craft, started dealing a bit in secondhand design. And it's just developed into this really enormous nationwide project where they are now promoting regional craft and design all over Japan, promoting Japanese design, some of it very, very everyday, great stuff. You know, it could just be a pen or a rubber band. So it doesn't have to be anything really obviously designer. And I think that's why it works so well. And what they've also done is they've gone to not all of the regions yet, but they're working their way through the regions of Japan and doing guidebooks, design guidebooks to each one. And they've just done one for Saga-ken, which is Saga Prefecture, which is in Kyushu. And, it, you know, it's not often looked at from a design perspective. And it's really exciting to see it, because, again, it's not like design as in big names, high design. It's really everyday stuff that is really, really used a lot, but it's very, very well designed. It's a lot of really good functional design. And then also just really great places to eat, interesting cafes, interesting small businesses. So it's a really brilliant alternative guide to Japan.
Do they have any plans to sort of take what they do abroad, to sort of showcase to the world all these interesting things that you can find around?
Well, I mean, what is so interesting about this whole project is that at the moment, it's really new to Japanese people. There was such a, I think in a way, there was such a fashion for everything foreign here for a while, that discovering all these things in Japan has been a really novel experience for young Japanese people. So that's been a huge wave, never mind introducing it to the rest of the world. I mean, just getting young people here to realise just the wealth of the craft tradition, the really good design, the great manufacturing. That's been a huge project just in itself. But, I mean, it can't be long before that could take off. I mean, they did a very good exhibition that I like, where they took a few crafts from all the prefectures in Japan and put it into one show. Now, that's a show that could travel easily. So it'd be great. Imagine if that turned up in London. Fantastic.
Aquarium art. from another exhibition. Let's talk about these fishes. Something fishy is going on in Tokyo.
I just couldn't miss this one. I thought, sorry, aquarium art, what is that? But, you know, there's something for everyone in Tokyo, I have to say. There's a niche market. And it turns out that, you know, obviously goldfish collecting, carp ponds, that's big news here. So I'm not surprised to hear that somebody is doing art involving goldfish. And it's this man called Hidetomo Kimura, who did a big exhibition here last year, actually, in Tokyo. And, you know, 500,000 people went to see this thing. It was a display of goldfish, and he does it with lighting and glass. It's very, very dramatic. It's just not what you're expecting. It's not like an aquarium. It's nothing like an aquarium. And the show he's about to do, which is opening on the 7th of March, is really timed to coincide with Cherry Blossom, which is obviously a huge event here. So it's a sort of Hanami aquarium. I mean, the description's extraordinary. I haven't seen it yet because the exhibition's not open, but it describes the chandelier, which has 1,000 glasses hand cut in Tokyo, and then goldfish all basically made to look like falling cherry blossom. I mean, you have to use your imagination, but I think it's one to see. It's in Nihonbashi, and the setting they've done is they're trying to recreate. Nihonbashi is a very historic area of Tokyo, and they're trying to recreate a sort of historic era feel, so to make it feel like Edo Tokyo, pre-modern Tokyo. So I think it'll be an interesting exhibition.
Yeah,
if we can ever get in. Yeah.
And back in the London office, we're just closing up our big retail survey for the next issue. On that subject, there's a new shop that you're interested in, isn't there?
Well, I mean, I just thought it's quite an interesting idea. Everyone's always trying to think, how can we make Japanese people buy contemporary art? It's quite difficult. They're not huge contemporary artists, even of Japanese contemporary art. And there's a magazine and an online magazine called Ima, and they're trying what they're calling their concept store. And it's basically, they're calling it Living with Photography. It's meant to make photography accessible. How do you incorporate photography? How do you buy it, put it into an interior? How do you include it in your life? And so they'll be selling the photographs. There's a cafe. They're going to have events. And they're trying to show photography as something that's not so much of a sort of inaccessible high art form that's too expensive for ordinary people. It's like, you know, anybody can buy a photograph and incorporate it into their apartment.
Why do you think it is that Japanese just aren't interested in that sort of thing, or there's no sort of heritage of it?
There's certainly more than there was, and you know, you've got a big contemporary art fair here now. Yeah. But all the dealers will say that, really, compared to what's happened in China, where the contemporary art boom has been extraordinary, and also South Korea, even, is it the prices for Japanese art have been, you know, surprisingly not the big names. There are a couple of absolutely massive names. You've got the Murakamis or Hiroshi Sugimoto, the photographer. So there is an interest, definitely, and people like to go and look at it. They love it, love going to look at strong history of photography here. But it's getting people to buy it for their homes. That's been the challenge. And for most art dealers, it's been more about 19th century art. That's been where the money is, or even older woodblock prints. So this is a kind of new market, and there are a lot of very active contemporary art dealers. And what Ima is doing is trying to integrate it into more of a lifestyle story. And it's opening in a building where there's Axis, which is a design magazine. There's an interior store, very good interior store, in that building in Roppongi. So it's a context for it. There's a very good ceramics shop, fabric shop. It's putting photography in this kind of lifestyle context. So I mean, right. It certainly looks very interesting.
Thanks, Fiona. This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Deep in the heart of Houston, Texas, lies the rather brilliantly named Randy Twaddle. He's an artist who has exhibited paintings and drawings across the US for 30 years, with his pieces hanging in a series of several public and private collections across the states. He also co-founded the creative agency Tweak in 1998, and 10 years after that, made the move into rug and textile design. A man of many talents, in 2007 he worked on a city branding project for Houston, inventing the slogan, "Houston, it's worth it." Our man in New York, Santiago Tarditi, flew to Texas to interview him about his career so far.
We started talking about campaigns for Houston, and we started to articulate what we thought a campaign for the city should be. We felt like the previous ones had been hyperbolic and silly and meaningless, and so I said, you know, it should be honest, and it should say, sure, it's hot as hell here, and we have mosquitoes and bad traffic and there's no view, no mountains, but it's worth it because we have a great cultural scene, we have great people, the food here is fantastic. And my partner said, Houston, it's worth it. And with no intention of creating anything, we both looked at each other and thought, that sounds fantastic. And if you lived here at the time and you travel and you meet someone and they say, where do you live? And you say, oh, I live in Houston. They go, ugh. So to be able to kind of have a retort and say, no, wait, it's worth it because of these things. So we came up with what we called the 20 afflictions of living here in Houston, the mosquitoes, the heat, the humidity. The last one was the no mountains. We created a website where people could write in and tell us why they thought Houston was worth it. And so it took off and we created t-shirts and all kinds of merchandise and stuff. And then we felt like, okay, people have told us why they think it's worth it. We were curious if it would translate into show us why you think it's worth it. So we did a call for entries and asked people to submit photographs of Houston. And we said, you know, we don't want the typical kind of iconic shot of downtown from Memorial Drive. We want your own idiosyncratic vision of why you think Houston's worth it.
Let's have a look. Why don't you take me through some of the pictures in there and maybe point out your favorite?
Well, we had a show at the Houston Center for Photography of all these photographs, and we asked people to vote for their favorite one, and we said, you know, if we do this book, the People's Choice Award will have a prominent place in the book. So the photograph that won was this photograph. And this is basically, this is the weather angle. This is Houston in December because there's a Christmas tree. There's a guy grilling with shorts, barefoot, no shirt, a Shiner Bock in his left hand, and his female friend lounging on a lounge chair. She appears to be scantily clad. We can only see the lower part of her legs with a fantastic tattoo on her calf. That was the favorite photograph. But it's the range, like, if three of us would have set out to photograph Houston, we wouldn't have come near the kind of oddness and range of the images in this. We have the Menil, a lot of the iconic places. People did submit photographs, but this is one of a dog behind some kind of ornate fence. The Astrodome, which is a classic Houston building, which may not exist much more. You know, storage. Houston has tons of these storage spaces. And then we incorporated text that people had submitted their comments. This was kind of an overall favorite in the office. It said, I feel normal here. Maybe it's because I'm imperfect like this city. This is the Astrodome after Hurricane Katrina, when we housed people who had come here from New Orleans to get away from the devastation there. Two people in I Dream of Jeannie outfits walking down with their smokes tucked into their panties, I guess. That's what you call those.
And that's book one. But there's also...
Then there's Hurricane Ike with images of post-Ike stories about, you know, sharing food and running power cords across roads so their neighbors could have power because power outages were really common. That book was really popular as well, and it provided a more personal kind of perspective on the hurricane. And the thing about Houston, I think, Houston does not have a single iconic, you know, first of all, the landscape's not iconic in any way. There's no beautiful bay or a mountain range or anything to look at. So there's nothing to look at here of interest. There's no particular architecture. The Menil's iconic in a way, but it's a very subtle, quiet kind of thing. The Astrodome actually probably is the building, but again, it's not being used and it may go away. So the real component of Houston, the real element of Houston that I think distinguishes it are the people here.
But also that DVD you have here, Interesting Times. What is that about?
Dr. Steven Kleinberg is professor of sociology, I suppose that's right, at Rice University. And he started a survey, and I believe it was 30 years ago, of asking Houstonians questions, a list of questions. And it was during the first oil boom. Then a year later, the oil bust came, and people were moving out of the city. The whole complexion of the city was really drastically altered because of that. So Stephen said, well, we have to ask these again. You know, he had no intention of any long-term plan, but he said, it's changed so much, we have to ask the same questions again. Well, they did that for 30 years, continuously, the same questions, plus they'd add specific kind of current temporal questions. It's the longest continuous run survey of a city in the United States. And so Tweet did this video to commemorate the 30th anniversary. And it's Stephen every year talks to the Greater Houston Partnership and presents the year's findings. And you know, his thesis is that Houston is what America looks like in the future because of the diversity. Houston was a Southern white city for a long time, and it is not anymore. It's Southern still, but it's not. It used to be just an oil-based economy completely, and now, you know, the largest medical center in the world is here. A lot of people doing cultural production here. So it's really changed, and Stephen thinks he's a very passionate, charismatic speaker too. So he's a great ambassador for the place.
That was Randy Twaddle in conversation with Santiago Tarditi. Coming up, we discuss the evolution of housing, aviation and transport design with Richard Horden and try on some socks in Istanbul. But first, let's head to Europe. Almost 70 years after the end of World War II, Austria has yet to come to terms with its Nazi past. And its well-preserved war-era architecture doesn't help matters. By far the most conspicuous examples are to be found in the capital, Vienna. Encircling the city's historic central district are six anti-aircraft defence towers. Huge and foreboding, they recall a deeply troubling period in the nation's history. For decades now, there has been endless debate over whether they should be given a facelift and put to new use, or left to rot away. Our Austria contributor, Alexei Korolyov, examines the controversy.
Allied aircraft bombard Vienna in the closing months of the Second World War. Although the war ended nearly 70 years ago, the reminders are all around. I am inside one of the Austrian capital's best-preserved anti-aircraft defence towers, the Leuchtturm, the radar tower, in the Arenberg Park. It has stayed almost untouched since the Soviet Red Army drove Nazi troops out of Austria in April 1945. Military historian Marcello La Speranza, who took me to the Leuchtturm, runs a museum about the towers. With walls up to 3 meters thick, they were built to last forever, he tells me. The flak towers were put up in pairs in parks just outside the city centre. The construction took place between 1942 and 1945 and was done by forced labour. On the walls inside, you can still see graffiti written by prisoners of war. Marcello La Speranza showed me some of it.
Viva la France! Heil Moskau!
There are also personal names, love poems and caricatures of Nazi leaders on the cold grey concrete. But why weren't these Nazi creations got rid of during Vienna's post-war reconstruction? One man who ought to know is Oliver Schreiber, a federal conservation officer who's taking part in the study of the towers.
It was a special situation in Vienna after the war. In Berlin and in Hamburg were also such towers. But British, American and also Russian troops, they tried to destroy these buildings. And in Vienna, there was another situation, maybe because they were erected within a very within an area that was used for living, and there were a lot of buildings around. Maybe this was the reason.
Although these concrete hulks were spared from destruction, there's been an endless stream of ideas for redeveloping them since the early 50s. One recent project proposed connecting the landmark towers by massive overhead platforms, while others envisaged turning them variously into hot air balloon stations, windmills or vegetable farms. When artists Christo and Jean-Claude stopped by here in the mid-70s, they of course wanted to wrap one of them in a giant piece of cloth.
That's a question how to deal with such monuments.
Oliver Schreiber at the Office for Federal Monuments disapproves of makeover projects.
And for me personally, as officer, They are monuments. They are monuments of itself. And to remodel it or to make like a farm park out of it, it's not really possible. Because these buildings, they represent a really dark era of the Austrian history. And if you know the history, and it's also a grave, it's not only a monument.
A grave nobody dares to look into, it seems.
To see how Austria was dealing with it, so it's erasing its...
Markus Hafner is the head of research group Faktum Fluktum, which studies wartime artifacts found at the towers, and he told me why Nazi-era architecture remains such a touchy issue for many Austrians.
It's like an ongoing coping with the fascistic air. You know, it's still very strong nowadays, and it's growing stronger. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why Austria is not willing to see these towers. And, you know, they're huge, they're enormous. So I started to build, like, Faktum Fluktum, and, this was the voice that was heard. We were the first that thought about, like, about the relics in the tower, you know, because they were all over the tower.
Hafner's enthusiasm didn't go well with the authorities, though.
We hurled out and said, okay, we have to inform a Vienna Museum, we have to collect this, we have to inform the media, and, you know, the city of Vienna wanted to throw us out, and we just like, okay, they cannot throw us out when we're starting this research, and yeah, in the end they threw us out and they locked the door.
Today, one of the flak towers houses an aquarium, and another is used by the Austrian army and is out of bounds. Yet another is leased by Vienna's Museum for Applied Arts for storage and occasional exhibitions. However, there is still much debate about the fate of the other three. Are they really worth all the hassle? I asked Dietmar Steiner, director of the Vienna Museum of Architecture, whether the towers are in fact of any great architectural value.
Friedrich Tams, the architect, he referred to the Stauferburgen, to Middle Ages towers, and the concept of the towers is very, very functional, because they are perfectly fitted in special axes of the city. So, sorry to say, it's well done. We met in the 80s one engineer who was involved in the construction of the towers, and he told us that they were also prepared for an atom bomb.
But when I asked Steiner what he thought should be done with the towers, his answer was firm and simple.
Nothing. Let it as it is.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Coming up, the architect Richard Horden reveals his micro-compact home project.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dan.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
A helicopter zooms across the valley of Lake Geneva. Below it suspended a small square box. It hovers above a grassy clearing on a hill and then deposits its burden atop the slope. 4 minutes and 9 seconds later, a house is born. A 2.6-metre-wide cube that accommodates a double bed, an 8-person dining table, inbuilt air conditioning, bathrooms and an espresso machine thrown in for good measure. This micro-compact home is the brainchild of UK-based Horden Cherry Lee Architects. Richard Horden sat down with Monocle's Alexa Firminich to discuss his studio's designs, the value of reduction in architecture, and how we can learn to look sideways in order to innovate.
It was a curious project. We were given a brief from the student union in the student housing authority in Munich. They wanted to have a new idea for student housing. So it was originally for students, but then I liked it so much I moved into one myself and discovered it was really nice. It's really luxury. It also comes from aviation, which I was describing here. You can see the business class. You know, we're very practiced now at making small spaces very luxurious. We're extremely experienced now at making these things. And how to get the lighting right, the sound systems, the videos, all of this is condensed in a good quality airline. So here you see the crew cabin. This is fascinating. There's a crew cabin in every Airbus A320 or 340 or 380. And this is in the same, under the hold, and it's where the crew sleep on the way to, if you're going on a long-haul flight. They have accommodation there. So we did this research in Munich. Lufthansa let us have a look at their crew cabins, which is really nice.
What gave you the idea to look at planes when you were designing the interior of the home?
Well, that's what I was saying earlier, that if you're innovating, you have to look sideways. You can't just look at architectural magazines, because the architectural magazines are full of rooms, and rooms are just garages for sofas, basically. Mm. You know, the house, the traditional house, to me, is a garage for sofas.
Were there any major difficulties that you encountered when you were trying to design them? And
oh, a lot. It's always a challenge. You know, design is, if it's not interesting unless it's a great challenge. So there were issues, yeah. But the project went remarkably smoothly. The main problem was how to configure the four human living spaces. We just need four spaces. As human beings, we just need four. Mm. Sleeping, hygiene, cooking and food preparation, and work. So it's just four. And if you can provide those, you have a home. It's very easy. It sounds easy, but getting that in the right order and getting it into a 2.6 meter cube is not so, took a lot of time and a lot of student work. This is my working place, and this is the pilot of an A320. So you see what I mean. The colors are parallel, the video screen. The parallels are incredibly important. Now, if you look at a modern car, you'll see the same display. In the car. So the car is developing from the aircraft, and the microhome develops from those, from being informed by both.
What's the greatest resistance that you come up against when you present the concept?
It is very, very extreme. You know, when people are used to 50 square meters or even 40 square meters, to say they should live in 5 square meters is a big, big, big change. And that requires great discipline. But to have that knowledge, I think, is extremely valuable.
Richard Horden of Horden Cherry Lee Architects speaking to Alexa Firminich. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. With proximity to markets in Europe, Central Asia and the Middle East, Turkey is, in no uncertain terms, a textile powerhouse. While the means of production are not an issue, Turkey has experienced difficulty producing homegrown fashion designers of note. But this is changing. One daughter of an established textile family is trying to break this mould with her very own bold label based in Istanbul. They make socks. And Monocle's Joseph Dana sat down with her to find out more about the growing number of Turkish designers venturing into the unknown with their own labels.
In Bebek, an upmarket neighbourhood just north of central Istanbul, you get a visceral sense of Turkey's unique geographic position. With breezes blowing off the Black Sea and the Asian continent just across the Bosphorus, Istanbul has long been a centre of international trade. And Bebek is its jewel. Despite a design heritage, however, local talent has been slow to emerge in the last 20 years. This trend is strange, given Turkey's developed textile industry. Thankfully, though, things are starting to change. I met Sezan İzmit, the designer behind 6x5 socks, at a sun-filled cafe in Bebek, to find out how Turkish designers are moving beyond the role of manufacturer and creating homegrown design. İzmit comes from a prominent textile family. She's trying to upend Turkey's lack of independent labels with her own sock company. And I started by asking for her design philosophy.
We want to be innovative in design. We want to try new things. We want to see how far we can go in socks design, because you have limits that you need to respect. We work close with the factories and we try new things. We want to make socks that people can complete their looks, their clothes, their ensembles with. Because when you look at the usual socks design, I don't know, I find them either too boring, like stripes or monocolors, or either too funny and happy, lots of patterns. And we wanted to give people some socks that they can really wear them and complete their clothes.
Because of Turkey's textile industry, do you find that being a designer in Bebek, making a textile is an advantage? I mean, do you have a very close relationship with the factories, or could you be doing this in London or Paris or somewhere else?
I think we have an advantage here because of the developed textile industry in Turkey. I've worked really close with the factories, but I have decided to open the office in Bebek here. It's a little far away from the factories because the industrial zone is a little outside the city. It's because here I'm closer to my clients and city people. It's better environment to get inspired and work.
So in terms of making socks, do you find that it presents an advantage because it's kind of by sex? You can make socks for men and women. You have a huge market in that way. Is that one of the reasons why you were attracted to socks specifically?
Yes, this is an advantage, and most of the designs we make are unisex designs. We have the same socks we have for men, for women. But because we make unisex socks, we have to find a common kind of design. We look at a design, we say, okay, men will wear this, women will wear this. If it's too girly or something, we don't make it, or we say we'll make this design only for women. But at the end, we sell more socks for men than women. That's interesting.
Is this a good city to be an independent designer in?
Yes, it's the perfect city to be a designer, but I had an advantage that I used because I'm coming from a family who was in the textile business for a long time. So I could create something like that and put it on the market, and so I can go on with it. But I think there are a lot of designers who just don't have this chance, and I think they're not being supported enough in Istanbul. You don't see a lot of international Turkish brands, you know. There are, of course there are, but not as much as it should be, because I know that there are design schools, fashion schools, a lot of very talented designers, and I want to see more Turkish designers that can create their own brands and go global afterward.
In many ways, socks are an ideal product for a Turkish design adventure. Options are limitless, as most designs can be worn by men and women. The designs of 6x5 blend classic lines with warm and inviting colors. Turkey's rich diversity of fabrics and noted history of craftsmanship is best experienced with one's feet, and İzmit's products certainly embrace a time-tested approach to comfort and design. Walk around the former fashion districts in Istanbul, like Beyoğlu's Galata neighborhood, and you will notice that local designers are starting to develop a footprint. There's a quiet renaissance in Turkish fashion, and companies like 6x5 are leading the change because of their intimate knowledge of Turkey's textile landscape. Who would have thought that this fashion revolution could start with socks?
That was Joseph Dana reporting, bringing us to the end of this week's edition of Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, to salute the questioned future of the Gardiner Expressway, as we heard at the top of the show, here's Express Yourself by Madonna. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.